This program is intended for a print-impaired audience and is brought to you by Mind's Eye.
Well, good evening, everyone, and welcome to Down to Business. My name is Jeff, and I'm recording this episode from the Mind's Eye studio just outside St. Louis in Belleville, Illinois. In today's episode, we'll explore a variety of stories from some of my favorite business publications, including Fast Company, Fortune, and Forbes. So settle in. It's time to get down to business. Our first story for this week's episode comes from Wired magazine, and it's entitled Why It's Impossible for Most Small Businesses to Manufacture in the U.S. American companies that make everything from keychains to mattresses say Chinese manufacturing is superior and tariffs won't be enough to shift production to the United States. Dallas-based small business owner Alan Walton says he just sold out of one of his products, a surveillance camera used by law enforcement and private detectives. That would normally be great news for Walton's electronics company, SpyGuy, which specializes in gadgets like GPS trackers and hidden camera detectors. But thanks to the Trump administration's ever-shifting tariff policies, Walton says he doesn't know if he should replenish his stock. His products are mostly manufactured in southern China, and the new additional 145% tariff on Chinese imports will completely change the economics of his business. Like almost every other electronic device on the market today, what Walton is selling isn't typically manufactured in the U.S., and all he can do is wait for the tariff situation to hopefully change again soon. It took me 5 years to finally rank the number one keyword on Google. That's why we ran out of stock. Now I don't know if it's worth it to have my hit products, so that's really frustrating, he says. As Trump has played a game of tariff peekaboo in recent weeks, repeatedly announcing new rates and then calling them off, business owners have struggled to contend with the whiplash and plan for the future of their companies. Wired spoke to over a dozen U.S. business owners, including mom-and-pop shops, fashion brands that have over $100 million in annual revenue, a tattoo supply vendor in Philadelphia, and a mattress maker in Ohio, who all said the same thing. Chinese manufacturing is still the gold standard of the world, and moving production to a new region would be extremely difficult, regardless of how high tariffs are. Walton can personally directly compare what it's like to manufacture in China versus the U.S. because his business takes orders from the U.S. government, which is willing to pay a premium for goods produced locally. Every consumer electronics manufacturer goes to China. I don't even know how to feasibly make something like that at a price point that would make sense for me and my customers that aren't the U.S. government, he says. Tariffs alone won't be enough to motivate companies to set up manufacturing in the U.S., says Kyle Chan, a Princeton University researcher who focuses on industrial policy. But let's say it does come back. I would really doubt whether it could be at the level of quality and price that American consumers have been enjoying for a long time, he says. Once an industry is gone, once you lose its broader ecosystem, then it's really, really hard to bring it back. Cost is undeniably an important reason why businesses choose to source from China, but experts say it's incorrect to assume that lower prices mean lower quality, and the reason manufacturing in China is cheaper than other regions doesn't always have to do with how much workers are paid. In fact, lower wages have become less important aspect of China's manufacturing strength as the country has moved up the value chain, says Eli Friedman, an associate professor studying China's labor force at Cornell University. You definitely can't say because wages in China factories are only 25% of what American counterparts are working for, that the quality is going to be 25% of the American product. That's much too simplistic a way to think about this. Cultural norms like working long orders and intentionally spending decades in the same industry often means that workers in China have become more skilled and specialized in certain areas. China is also a world leader in the production of industrial tools, which means factories can easily adjust machinery to fit the ever-changing needs of their customers. As a result, Chinese factories are often more responsive to customization demands from clients and more capable of precisely orchestrating their careful design intentions. Casey McDermott, co-founder of the jigsaw puzzle company GoodFit, says it's definitely a customer misconception that quality from China is cheap. Customers often ask if GoodFit's puzzles are made in China. They are. So McDermott says she tried to find a local company that could produce them. The manufacturer she found quoted her 3 times the price she is currently paying, but still couldn't meet the same production standards as her supplier in China, which has been in the business for decades and developed specialized expertise over time. Our boxes are a thick, soft-touch matte material. Our puzzle pieces themselves have a very tight and satisfying fit. They are thick and don't bend and are finished with a canvas-like coating, says McDermott. These are all details which domestic factories were not able to replicate for us. Another reason that small and micro businesses in particular turn to China for manufacturing is the opportunity to do small production runs. Suppliers in other countries often need to import the raw materials from China, regardless, making it economically viable to produce an item only if a customer orders, say, thousands of units or more in some cases. Melissa, an artist who makes acrylic keychains, says she can place orders with a Chinese supplier for as little as 3 units at a time. This is amazing for artists who have a lot of designs but aren't able to sell 50 plus of each one, says Melissa, who asked only to use her first name for privacy reasons. Products are sometimes simply unavailable anywhere else but China. Jeff Logan, the owner of Tots Supplies in Levittown, Pennsylvania, has been in the tattoo business since 1990s, long before a German company invented the permade tattoo needle cartridges that have since become the industry standard. Logan says there are currently no American companies that make the cartridges, and European ones don't allow shops like his to add their own branding. That left him with only one option, China. But another nice thing about working with Chinese suppliers is that they frequently also sell all of the other tattoo supplies he needs. Literally, I can get everything you would need to set up a tattoo shop, Logan says. I hate to say it, I think they beat us at capitalism. Logan is describing a key part of what has given China an edge in the global manufacturing industry. The country has a massive population, and there are entire towns or even clusters of towns that specialize in producing specific products or items for specific industries, says Lin Zhang, an associate professor at the University of New Hampshire, who has conducted field work in China at small factories and interviewed local sellers. For example, the town of Beilun in eastern China is home to over 3,000 mold factories, which produce anything from cake molds to molds for making Tesla car parts. A few hours away in the town of Guiyu, there are roughly 1,300 factories that manufacture street lamps and other kinds of road lighting. When one factory in one of those towns designs a new product, others nearby can quickly copy it or produce their own slightly different version. There's even a Chinese word for these kinds of dupes, Shanghai, creating such a densely concentrated and rapidly iterative ecosystem like this took years of concentrated effort. It all requires a significant amount of flexibility of the supply chain. I don't think any of this is built in a day. It requires long-term cooperation between technical workers on different levels, Zhang says. Many U.S. business owners told Wired that when they explored manufacturing domestically in the past, they have run into a wide range of challenges such as higher cost, trouble sourcing raw materials, lack of available labor, and regulatory restrictions. Logan says he once went through the whole idea of starting his own needle cartridge manufacturing line here in the U.S., but he learned that it would cost him $8 to $10 million just to get the factory up and running, including the cost of machinery, making molds, and building a sterilization department. China is also the only country that produces the automated machines he would need, which are still subject to Trump's tariffs if we were to try to go onshore right now. Kim Vaccarella, the founder and CEO of a handbag company called Bog Mistakes Products out of EVA, a rubber-like petroleum byproduct also used for flip-flops and yoga mats. Vaccarella says it's possible to make EVA products in Vietnam, but when she researched sourcing from there, she found that a lot of the factories were Chinese-owned and employed Chinese engineers. China has mastered EVA. They've been doing shoes in EVA for 20-plus years, so it really was our first choice, Vaccarella says. If Bog tried to move its manufacturing to the U.S., Vaccarella says she believes she would also need to hire Chinese talent to help ensure the production lines were set up correctly. But she worries that would be difficult, especially given the Trump administration's current policies to reduce immigration. With everything going on with our borders, it's going to be hard to get the visas for the Chinese counterparts to come in and be able to help us build this business. Another challenge is that the supply chain for many products is already fully globalized, with different steps spread out between different regions that each have their own unique comparative advantage. Take lithium for a battery, for example, which may be first mined in Chile or Australia, then sent to China for refinement, then sent to Japan or Korea to be packaged, and then finally shipped to Europe or the U.S. to be put into a car. Moving those kinds of supply chains to the U.S. would essentially mean that U.S. factories have to win out across every single node, not just the final product. And I think that's a real challenge, says Hugh Grant Chapman, an associate fellow at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, studying trade and politics in the context of U.S.-China relations. With Trump's tariff policies seemingly changing almost every week, business owners don't know what the status of their companies will be tomorrow. Some have stopped placing orders for products and supplies for the time being, while others are closing down, at least temporarily. Walton, the seller of spy equipment, says he is not ordering from China at the moment, but some of his colleagues have containers of products currently in transit to the U.S. and are anxiously checking every day when the new tariff rate on them is going to be. He has also heard some friends are preemptively laying off employees to prepare for potential economic difficulties ahead. Ultimately, businesses want things to be at the right price, and they don't want to lose customers or employees, says Charlotte Palermo, the co-founder of skincare brand Dew. What has been vocal about the impacts of the tariffs on social media? What these tariffs are doing is that they are making us choose between our employees and our customers. Either way, it's bad for the economy. Our next article for this week's episode comes from Business Insider, and it's called Businesses Can Use Trump's Tariffs to Raise Prices Faster Than Ever. If you feel like you have no idea what anything's supposed to cost anymore, you're not alone. The pandemic and subsequent bout of inflation sent prices all over the place, and now we're facing down whatever is going on with tariffs at any given moment. Unfortunately, our collective state of sticker, huh, is likely to get worse. Thanks to a whipsawing economic landscape and the magic of technology, prices can change faster than ever. The price you see in the morning may not be the same that afternoon. Maybe the new price tag is the result of changing supply and demand dynamics. Maybe it's tariffs. Maybe it's corporate funny business. The unfunny part is that it's impossible for many consumers to know. You might remember the brief dust-up around Wendy's and dynamic pricing last year. Its CEO said on an earnings call that the company was going to test out variations and AI-enabled menu changes, and the intent did a little bit of a freakout. The episode was a sign of the times. Rapid-fire price changes are everywhere. Thanks to digital price tags, QR codes, and the shift to online shopping, it's easier than ever for companies to move prices at the drop of a hat. The pandemic helped firms get more agile at reacting to shocks in the system. Instability represents a prime opportunity to make adjustments, including to a business's benefit. Given this really uncertain, volatile environment, if you're a company who's been thinking of doing dynamic pricing, it could be a good opportunity, said John Zhang, a marketing professor at the University of Pennsylvania's Wharton School of Business, who studies pricing strategies and targeting. This could be a good occasion, a good excuse, an alibi for them to move in that direction. It used to be the case that dynamic pricing, meaning the price of something moving up or down based on market conditions, was largely reserved for flights, hotels, and Ubers. Consumers didn't love the idea their airfare in July was going to run them double what it would cost in February, but they got it. These are the rules of supply and demand. But variable pricing is creeping across the economy, including places where it feels a little less understandable. Now we're in a super dynamic environment, given the uncertainty emanating from the White House and the global economy. In turn, it's a moment for a super dynamic approach to prices. Volatility is always a part of business, but now we're facing the trifecta of volatility, says Craig Zawada, chief visionary officer at Pros Holding, a private optimization company. First, costs are changing quickly. In the past, a company might negotiate once or twice a year with a supplier. but now they're having to review their agreements all the time. Second, competitive fluctuations are happening. Businesses in the same industry tend to have similar inputs, but not always. If the guy next door imports from China and you don't, you've got an advantage. But if you see them increase their asking price, do you bump yours up a little anyway? Third, customer demand is shifting and not always in ways that are obvious or predictable or even bad. In times of economic precarity, sales of items such as lipstick and mini bottles of alcohol tend to go up. All of those dynamics in this volatile environment, if you're thinking about it as a business owner, how do you thrive? How do you do better? You need to understand all of those things. That's where technology comes in. It's much easier now to have visibility on costs, see the reactions to the market, and then respond with prices. Customers recognize how volatile things are and may expect price changes. The willingness to accept these adjustments makes it easier for businesses to do some resets and expand their margins in competitive areas to get more breathing room. This is the type of margin padding some companies did this more recent episode of inflation. And if customers reject the increases, businesses can see that too. Sheikha Jain, the lead partner for consumer and retail for North America at Simon Kucher, a business consultancy, said that determining the price of a good is a lot more than just picking a number. What does it do for customer demand? How do we balance acquisition and retention? What does that mean for our internal balance sheet and cash flow in terms of our P&L, or profits and losses, she said? And what does it mean from a competition and market landscape standpoint? She pointed out that companies have gotten better at figuring all of this out in recent years, especially in the wake of the pandemic that was wildly disruptive to supply chains and consumer behavior across the globe. We haven't had a stable environment in a long time, she said. Customers do not like dynamic pricing, even if it sometimes works to their benefit. Happy hour is dynamic pricing, as are early bird specials, last-minute flight deals, and flash sales. But to many people, costs constantly moving up and down feels manipulative. They're suspicious. It's going to actually work in their favor. It's also the case that dynamic pricing isn't really designed to handle what's happening now. It's usually about supply and demand, that Saturday night taxi being much hotter commodity than the same one on a Sunday at 2 p.m., not about whether the president of the U.S. will jack up the price of everything coming out of China. This is a completely different situation where you're looking to government policy and how that could change very quickly, and how you would change your prices in response, says Eric Greenleaf, a marketing professor at NYU. Businesses that sell online can change prices quickly or just ride the wave of the Amazon algorithm. Some supermarket and big box stores, such as Walmart, now have digital price stickers that can be adjusted in real time. Consumers are likely to be somewhat understanding that companies aren't having a good time with tariff by tweet. One risk business faced in the slick dynamic pricing tactics, however, is that customers may view it as a little too slick. Too blunt, any backlash, they may want to pass the buck a bit. So the next time you go to the grocery store and pick up your favorite coffee brand, and it seems pricier than you remember, maybe there's a little asterisk next to the price tag, and that reads, "This price increase was brought to you by President Trump, not me." There'll be a lot of firms, and this is easier online, where they can literally say, "Here's what we wanted to charge you. Here's the tariff. Here's the total price that you're paying," Greenleaf said. Of course, that will probably upset the Trump administration, but businesses want to make clear that they're not profiting out of this. It's not that different from restaurants slapping on egg surcharges earlier this year. Were wholesale eggs more expensive? Yes. Was it easy for customers to wonder whether they were justifying 50 cents an egg at a Waffle House more expensive? Also yes. But Zhang from Warden said that a tariff surcharge may be a better way to go for businesses than plugging tariffs into whatever pricing algorithm. They can take it off once the tariffs go away, and it's easier to calculate than whenever incremental adjustments happen across the supply chain. Plus, he says, you can just blame Trump. Not knowing who's to blame is, of course, part of the problem from a consumer perspective. And just because tariffs go away and companies cool it on all the price changes doesn't mean that the sour taste is left in people's mouths will fade so fast. Whereas tariffs can change rather quickly, consumer optimism takes longer to recover. Consumers are exhausted. The past 5 years have been filled with upheaval, and the chaos feels unrelenting. It's understandable people just want their shampoo to cost what it costs. No games. But the economy is increasingly gamified, including on pricing, whether or not people even want to play. Our next article is found at CNBC, entitled "Unemployment Fears Hit Worst Level Since COVID as Tariffs Fuel Inflation Outlook," Fed survey shows. Consumer worries grew over inflation, unemployment, and the stock market as the global trade war heated up in March, according to a new Fed survey. The probability that the unemployment rate would be higher a year from now surged to 44%, up 4.6 percentage points at the highest level going back to early COVID pandemic days of 2020. The expectation that the market will be higher a year from now slid to 33.8%, a decline of 3.2 percentage points to the lowest reading going back to 2022. Consumer worries grew over inflation, unemployment, and the stock market as the global trade war heated up in March. The central bank's monthly survey of consumer expectations showed that respondents saw inflation a year from now at 3.6%, an increase of half a percentage point from February, and the highest reading since October 23. Along with concerns over a higher cost of living came a surge in worries over the labor market. The probability that the unemployment rate would be higher a year from now surged to 44%, a move up of 4.6 percentage points and the highest level going back to early COVID pandemic days of April 2020. The survey also showed angst about the uncertainty translating into problems for stock market prices. The expectation that the market will be higher a year from now slid to 33.8%, a decline of 3.2 percentage points to the lowest reading going back to 22. While the expectations for equities pulled back, respondents said they figure gold to rise by 5.2%, the highest since April of 22. The survey reflects other readings, such as the University of Michigan Consumer Sentiment Survey, which showed one-year expectations in mid-April at their highest since November of 1981. In the case of the New York Fed's measure, the survey took place ahead of President Donald Trump's April 2nd Liberation Day tariff announcements, as well as the 90-day suspension of the order a week later. However, it is largely consistent with other measures reflecting consumer concern over the impact tariffs will have, even as market-based measures show inflation worries are low among traders. Expectations for inflation at the five-year horizon actually edged lower to 2.9%, down 0.1 percentage point, and were unchanged for the three-year outlook at 3%. The outlook for food prices for a year from now nudged up to 5.2%, its highest since May of 2024, and was at 7.2% for rent, an increase of a half a point. The outlook for medical care costs also jumped an expected 7.9% increase, the most since August of 24. Respondents expect gasoline to rise by 3.2%. The next article for this week's episode comes from BuzzFeed, entitled 18 Small Business Owners Reacted to Trump's Latest Tariffs, and It's Way Worse Than I Thought. I sell bamboo clothing and bedding, and now with this tariff, it's likely I will have to close. Tariffs, and more tariffs are coming from the Trump administration, and small businesses, which make up nearly half of all private sector employment in the U.S., are taking the hit. An economist told CBS, for many small businesses, this is a 1-2 punch. They are getting higher prices from suppliers, and their customers are more skittish just as they're grappling with heavier tariffs. Here are 18 small business owners saying about Trump's tariffs over the Reddit small business thread. Number one, I sell bamboo clothing and bedding, and now with this tariff, I will likely have to close. Number two, this completely guts our business and leaves us with no alternatives or hopes for alternatives. Number three, my main supplier just informed me of 17% price increases effective this past Monday. Yikes. Number four, two of our most reliable clients that were very wealthy and always won a ton of work have canceled due to the uncertainty of their futures. Two others canceled and are retirees. All have said they are worried and buckling down. Number five, I'm in the process of dissolving. The constant tariff back and forth is really not a stable way to run a company. I'm just done. Number six, my supplier recently raised their prices on things like energy drinks, and I simply raised my retail prices in response. When I'm the consumer in the situation, these added fees rub me the wrong way. Number seven, as a repair store, we are already seeing the price rise in many components for laptops and desktops. And being a small business, we don't have the margins to survive something like this without serious downsizing. Number eight, I'm a small business in a small town. We cannot survive the tariffs. Number nine, I own a small publishing company. My suppliers have already raised prices 20% on water heaters and equipment from China and Canada. We've passed those price increases on to the end customer. Number 10, Donald Trump ruined my business. Number 11, I have a small business making drums. All of the tariffs will do is raise the cost, and thus the price of the product that I sell. Number 12, we were paying around $1.20 per pound of imported steel that just jumped to $1.32. Number 13, just last week, the U.S. tariff on our category jumped from 34% to 104%. One of our American customers said, "There's no way I can make a profit now." Number 14, it feels like a lot of businesses are in wait-and-see mode, hesitant to make big commitments but still needing to move products around. Number 15, these U.S. tariffs will be disastrous for my small jewelry business, mainly relying on U.S. exports. It's like a punch in the gut. Number 16, the 145% tariff hits next month. For anyone sourcing from China, this isn't a bump. It's a wrecking ball. Number 17, I'm going to add Trump tariff surcharge, 37% on mine. I fear this will turn people away, but I also need to be honest and transparent. And finally, number 18, anyone here stuck with inventory in China because of the new 125% tariffs? Our next story comes from Business Insider. Trump's tariffs are going to hit my small cookie business hard. I am a classically trained pastry chef, and I previously worked for a restaurant group. But at some point in the last 5 years, I realized that I hated my job. I was so tired of working for other people. I started a TikTok, and my content went viral in the first month. I posted a video last May asking if people would buy my cookies, and the response was overwhelmingly yes. I launched this business in December. I sell the cookies by the half dozen, with five core flavors and one rotating seasonal taste. A regular box of six costs $27, and I sell about 3,000 cookies monthly. All of the cookies have fun names like Snarky Snickerdoodle, Chocolate Fucking Chip, and Oatmeal Raisin Hell. Expensive eggs and chocolate have hit me hard. The first blow to my business was soaring egg and chocolate prices. In December, the eggs I bought were less than $100 for a case of 180, but in mid-February, they were $145 for that same case. I've seen chocolate prices rise 60% since December. That means the price of my ingredients skyrocketed too. Ingredient cost went from 18.5% of my total cost to about 23% in February, which is huge for a small business like mine. Trump's tariffs have made everything feel like it's in a free fall, and there's a 100% chance I will be affected by his tariffs on China. I source my cookie bags from a company called PouchMe, which is based in Shanghai. I love them because they're so well customized and of good quality. They are also way more affordable than what I can get in the U.S. I order 12 to 14 different designs from Pouch at a time, and they cost 52 cents when I was buying 3,000 bags at a go. Recently, I purchased a larger quantity of 6,000 bags at 38 cents each. I emailed them a couple of days ago asking about the tariffs, and they said there's currently no change in prices on their end, but that I should be mindful of price increases that will be coming. After the tariffs started, I tried looking at other suppliers in the U.S., but I found that these U.S.-based suppliers are also used to working with big companies, but not very good working with small businesses like mine. The cheapest quote was from a company charging $1.02 per bag, with a minimum order of 6,000 bags per design. It was just so far out of my price range. Another one quoted me a $10,000 minimum order, and I just couldn't commit to something like that. There's lots of uncertainty in the business. I've thought about stocking up with a big bulk order from Pouch so that I'm covered for the next couple of months, but I'm hesitant. I don't know what the impact the tariffs will have. Maybe I'll regret not doing a bulk order. It's all so up in the air right now. I want to maintain the same quality that I am proud of with my product, but I'm worried. What happens if egg prices skyrocket again? What happens if chocolate prices double? I'm worried that if prices get too high, I won't be able to do that and will have to shift to cheaper alternatives. People on TikTok and Instagram were supportive when I said the prices for my cookie boxes might go up. But I don't think I'm going to do that. It just feels wrong. I'd rather find some other way to not pass the price on to the customer. But we'll see. Maybe I'll have to eat my words. Our next article comes from Fox News. It's an opinion piece called "The Right Starts to Sound Like the Left on Tariffs. That's Not America First." In 2020, when the COVID panic hit the U.S., it was a bad era for freedom, property rights, Main Street, and the American dream. The mantra driven heavily by the left was that small businesses needed to be closed and that personal freedoms needed to be limited to meet their narrative. The left screamed, "Do something," with no regard if that something would produce better or worse outcomes. States across the country took what make America great and threw it in the toilet, opting for heavy-handed central planning instead of allowing people to make decisions on what was best for them. This was based on faulty information, bad strategy and tactics, and a large-scale willingness to forego personal freedom. Many of us who warned about this were met with resistance for quite some time. Eventually, more people came around to the mistakes and promised this would not happen again. Today, embedded in the discourse around tariffs, we are seeing many of the same behaviors and language, but staggeringly, it is many on the right that are standing on the wrong side of freedom. There are no doubt myriad financial issues plaguing the U.S. today. The Biden administration left the Trump administration a giant financial mess. After Biden propped up growth with massive deficit spending, our U.S. debt GDP grew to north of 120%. Our deficit GDP in the 6-7 range is now that of a country at war. Our spending on interest to service our debt exceeds U.S. defense spending, which is a massive warning sign. Biden's historic inflation remains difficult to combat. The Trump administration's options are limited given all of the above, current interest rates, massive financing and refinancing of debt that needs to happen this year, and other factors. However, tariffs are unlikely to work as a tactic to solve the above. Trump risks it all, takes on the world with tariffs, and puts America first. In the panic of, quote, "do something," many Trump supporters are sacrificing principles, sounding more like the left than purveyors of conservative values. Small businesses who bore the brunt of the COVID mandates, their after effects and inflation are now at risk again. Those who have part or all of their supply chains abroad are going to have a hard time surviving if this goes on much longer, and they are not exempted from tariffs. I have heard over and over again on social media that those businesses don't deserve to exist. Basically the same thing that I wrote about in The War on Small Businesses after COVID, when the left told small businesses they needed to close for the greater good as they defined it. That's not freedom or America First. That's central planning garbage. Moreover, most of those spewing rhetoric don't realize that small businesses that have part of their business abroad is still America First. Small businesses in the U.S. exploit competitive advantages in the supply chain. The same businesses often have personnel in design, marketing, sales, administration, and other functions in the U.S. that create American jobs. They may sell all over the globe, getting desired products not just to Americans, but to citizens of other countries as well. When those foreign citizens buy the products, they are supporting American jobs and sending their capital to the U.S. Those profits are invested and spent often in America. Telling these businesses not to exist in support of the greater good is communist-type thinking. Moreover, if millions of these small businesses go under, not only will those jobs, profits, and capital be removed from America, it is likely a foreign company or a massive corporation who will pick up the opportunity and benefit. That's not America first. We have many issues to solve economically, but most of those have been caused by moving away from freedom and capitalism. Going further in that direction leaves us without principles and will likely make matters worse. Hopefully, the Trump administration will help Main Street thrive, but that needs to be done with incentives, not with anti-freedom barriers. Our next article is from Fast Company magazine entitled, America's Loss is China's Gain. Beijing is recruiting fired U.S. scientists. U.S. officials view the recruitment effort as part of a broader Chinese strategy to acquire advanced technological expertise through non-traditional channels. China appears to be pursuing a calculated effort to recruit recently laid off U.S. scientists, particularly those with expertise in artificial intelligence, to relocate or contribute remotely to research operations based in Shenzhen. This campaign is reportedly being driven by a network of entities linked to a shadowy Chinese technology conglomerate. In March, advertisements offering full-cycle support for relocation to Shenzhen were placed on LinkedIn, Craigslist, and in several major international publications. I was alerted to one such newspaper ad through a friend in the city. The timing coincides with a wave of budget-driven layoffs across U.S. federal agencies, including the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention and the National Institutes of Health, following funding reductions by the Department of Governmental Efficiency, or DOGE. The recruitment effort has drawn scrutiny from U.S. officials and intelligence analysts who view it as part of a broader Chinese strategy to acquire advanced technological expertise through non-traditional channels. The FBI has previously warned that Chinese talent programs may serve as mechanisms to extract intellectual property and sensitive research from foreign institutions under the guise of academic or professional collaboration. Laid-off federal employees with security clearances or institutional knowledge are considered particularly vulnerable. Analysts suggest that financial strain and professional uncertainty may make these individuals more susceptible to overtures from foreign entities. While international recruitment of scientific talent is not unusual, the circumstances surrounding this initiative, particularly the use of potentially deceptive firms or the targeting of a freshly displaced U.S. workforce, raise significant counterintelligence and national security concerns. In response, U.S. agencies are reviewing protocols for layoffs involving sensitive personnel, including strengthening exit briefings and restrictions on post-employment affiliations. Platforms like LinkedIn have also stepped up efforts to detect and remove fraudulent recruiter profiles, which are often used in foreign influence and espionage operations. Shenzhen's emergence as a global innovation hub is a relevant factor. Since being designated a special economic zone in the 1980s, the city has attracted significant investment and become a core node in China's technological ecosystem. Many U.S. companies have long-standing relationships in the region, leveraging its capacity for rapid prototyping and cost-effective manufacturing. There is reason to believe that China may frame Shenzhen as a politically and neutral environment for scientific work, potentially increasing its appeal to foreign researchers. Sources familiar with current efforts tell me that remote collaboration options are being offered to further lower barriers, allowing scientists to contribute to Chinese research initiatives without relocating. However, analysts caution that any scientific contribution, remote or otherwise, ultimately supports the interest of the Chinese state. Shenzhen operates within the political and regulatory framework of the People's Republic of China, and research conducted there is unlikely to remain fully compartmentalized or independent. Additionally, former U.S. government employees with security clearances may face legal and regulatory constraints that bar them from working with Chinese research entities, including academic institutions. The recruitment campaign highlights a broader strategy. Competition between the U.S. and China over leadership in critical technologies, particularly artificial intelligence. In this context, the targeting of displaced American scientific personnel represents a pragmatic, if provocative, maneuver by Beijing. While it remains uncertain how effective this strategy will be, it reflects a sophisticated understanding of the intersection between economic dislocation and talent acquisition, and reinforces the urgency of policy responses that address both national security and workforce resilience. Sticking with Fast Company, our next article is entitled, How Your Family Dynamics Influence Your Personality at Work. The person you were inside your family relationship can impact how you act in the workplace today, says this psychologist. Thinking back to childhood, what role did you play in your family dynamic? Maybe you were the straight-A student. Maybe you flew under the radar, not causing trouble. Or perhaps you were charged with taking care of siblings. The person you were inside your family relationship can impact how you act in the workplace today, says Dr. Alexandra Solomon, clinical psychologist and host of the master's class In Practice series on dealing with anxiety. Sometimes we repeat those family roles in our adult relationships, and sometimes we do a 180-degree flip, she says. There's a path of repetition and there's a path of opposition. Our goal is to be on the third path, which is the path of integration. Solomon identified six common roles that children play inside of their families based on their experiences. People tend to identify with one or two roles. Roles can also change, often due to a shift in the family dynamics, such as a divorce, a death, or an older sibling heading off to college. Each role has a function with two parts, explained Solomon. The individual takes on this role in an attempt to belong and access love, she says, and the person takes on this role in an attempt to stabilize the family system. First, the perfect one. A child who assumes the role of the perfect one attempts to gain love through performance. They stabilize the system by being a straight-A student or a superstar athlete so the family can feel good about itself. In the workplace, the perfect one's gift is competence. If you give them a project, you can be pretty sure that it will be done and done well, says Solomon. The challenge is that the perfect ones tend to be hard on themselves and oftentimes demanding and critical of the people around them. Number two, the easy one. The family member who is the easy one tries to obtain love by going with the flow. They create stability for the system by not adding any more strain, which often happens when parents are stressed. The easy one attempts to help their parents feel as calm as possible by needing less. Their gift at work is flexibility, which is an asset on a team because you can put them anywhere and they'll figure it out without asking too many questions or being a squeaky wheel. Their challenge, however, is that they can end up feeling resentful because their needs aren't being met. Third, the struggling one. The child who is the struggling one is often the center of attention. Solomon says this role captures an idea from the family therapy called the identified patient. This happens when parents bring a child to therapy saying, "Our kid is having a problem." It's possible that they are focusing on the child to avoid their own marital conflict. To gain stability, the child may back up what the parent says as long as it keeps the parents from fighting with each other. It's possible, too, that the child has identifiable challenges. The struggling one's gift as a coworker is that they become a strong advocate, says Solomon. They make people around them feel safe because they have struggled, too. The challenge, however, is that they need to be more independent. The peacemaker, number four. The peacemaker's role in the family is to help people get along. They gain love by solving problems, such as getting parents in conflict to understand each other. Even at a young age, they try to have everyone's best interest at heart. In the workplace, the peacemaker's gift is an eye for fairness, advocacy, and mediation. They help everyone understand each other's perspectives, and they're unafraid to get in the mix. The challenge, however, is that they spend so much time with their finger on the pulse of the system, anticipating a problem, that they have a hard time accessing their own emotions. Number five, the parentified child. The parentified child is someone who attempts to gain love by providing a source of comfort to the grown-ups in the family. This role is similar to the peacemaker, however, they offer more support for issues rather than trying to solve them. They act like a little adult in the household. The parentified child's gift at work is having empathy and caregiving for others. Their challenge, though, is that they often have difficulty with boundaries, and they often define their worthiness by the degree to which they are needed by others. And finally, number six, the rebel. The final role is the rebel. This is someone who isn't afraid to call out how the family dynamic isn't making sense or working. They attempt to gain love through authenticity, speaking up and trying to create stability by calling out what's happening. The rebel's gift is fearlessness, saying the things that nobody else wants to say. The challenge, especially in peer-to-peer relationships, is that their self-identity is organized around opposition to the system. It can be hard to meld into a group when you spend time pointing out the things that are wrong, says Solomon. How your role applies to the workplace. Carl Jung said, until you make the unconscious conscious, it's going to direct your life. And you're going to call it fate, says Solomon. We're usually not conscious of our role, and we don't usually have language for our role. We just do relationships the way we've always done relationships. Once you recognize the role you played in your family, you can still start to notice core pain points at work that connect to a role you played. If you have a difficult boss, for example, it's not just about a difficult boss. It's what you do in the face of a situation with the difficult boss. A rebel might feel like calling foul on their boss. The more the rebel calls foul, however, the more the difficult boss is frustrated with the rebel. You can take a step back, realize your go-to reaction, and consider options of what you can do differently. You may not be able to change your boss, but you can become more empowered and not fall into the same pattern, says Solomon. The rebel may want to figure out what they can let go of. If they notice the urge to speak up, what will happen if they stay quiet? Maybe somebody else speaks up, or maybe they realize it wasn't the end of the world. It's about trying a different behavior and noticing what the different outcome is instead of being led by knee-jerk responses. Your coworkers' roles are understanding that we bring family roles into work and can also help you create hypotheses about why your coworkers act the way they do, which can help you feel less reactive to their behavior. If I watch my coworker pointing out to the boss again and again everything they did, you might start to wonder if they were the perfect one in their family, and the only way they think they can be safe and belong is to prove their value again and again. Maybe you can have compassion. It may drive you crazy, but if you see that it's their family of origin wound, you can take it less personally. They're doing that because what they believe they have to do is seen as valuable. Stress and anxiety are inevitable at work. The good news is you don't have to be a helpless victim. There are things we can't change about our workplace, about the state of the world, about other people's behavior, and the things that happened to us in the past. But we can get insight about why things seem the way they do. The experience of doing something different in a difficult moment reinforces a feeling of trust in itself, which is vital. And our final article for this week's episode stays with Fast Company. What if Apple Vision Pro's killer app is the AI girlfriend? As AI partners grow smarter and more lifelike, the line between real and artificial relationships is vanishing. Blade Runner wasn't so far-fetched after all. In Blade Runner 2049, Ryan Gosling's officer K has a live-in girlfriend named Joy, played by Ana de Armas. The two interact like a real couple. They share familiar banter and seem to have a history together. But Joy is a hologram, projected from ceiling-mounted emitters in K's apartment. She's not human. She's an advanced form of spatial computing, a future-facing concept we're already seeing the early stages of today. The AI girlfriend or boyfriend is no longer just science fiction. It's quickly becoming a cultural reality. The concept raises both social and technological questions. In the film, Officer K chooses Joy in part because he isn't human himself. But here in 2025, as people are spending increasing amounts of time in online and virtual spaces, they're more and more likely to choose digital companionship over human relationships. Generative AI is already remarkably good at simulating emotional intimacy. It can craft a persona that listens, supports, and never judges. These AI companions can learn your quirks, understand your personal challenges, and respond with surprising emotional intelligence. They remember shared moments, build a simulated history with their users, and interpret new interactions through the lens of that shared memory. Even though these relationships currently unfold through text windows on phones and laptops, the demand is clear. A 2024 MIT study said that the second most common user of ChatGPT was some sort of intimacy role play. Meanwhile, Character.ai drew both popularity and controversy for offering AI companions willing to engage in almost any kind of conversation. We may not have home hologram systems yet, but we do have more accessible, if still awkward, form of spatial computing, augmented reality. And in the next few years, generative AI and spatial computing are likely to merge. One key driver of this is Apple's Vision Pro headset. Until recently, AR hardware wasn't immersive or comfortable enough to hold a user's attention for long. Apple changed that, and the Vision Pro is engaging, comfortable, and for some, so compelling that users lose track of time while wearing it. The $3,500 price tag may seem steep, especially if you see it as just another screen for work or entertainment. But what if that could project your digital partner in vivid, life-size clarity, standing in your living room or sitting beside you on the couch? What if it could bring back the likenesses of a loved one who passed away? Whether or not Apple delivers that future remains to be seen. The company is making a big push to integrate Apple intelligence into its devices. Vision apps will almost certainly evolve to become more interactive and personalized with AI. So far, however, Apple has said little about bridging or bringing AI to Vision OS, its spatial computing platform. Of course, even immersive AR has its limits. In both Blade Runner and Her, characters attempt physical intimacy with AI through surrogate stand-ins. In Blade Runner, Joy overlays her holographic image onto the replicant Mariette. In Her, Samantha arranges for a woman named Isabella to act as the physical body while she provides the voice. In both stories, the experiences are unsettling. Still, companies are already working to bridge the physical-digital divide. Apple prohibits adults-only content, including pornography, in its app stores, Vision OS included. However, its content ratings do allow for apps labeled 17+, which may include frequent or intense sexual content or nudity. So while Apple may not lead the charge into sexually immersive AI companionship, the space is wide open for others. As AR headsets get cheaper and more widespread, the real hook will be the software. MIT researchers Robert Mahari and Pat Pazathanian have warned that AI's constant validation and charm could become addictive, encouraging people to abandon the unpredictability and imperfection of human relationships. The line between intimacy and illusion is getting blurrier, and we're stepping over it willingly. I've fretted more than once in this newsletter over the fact that AI researchers can't fully explain how large language models generate their outputs. And that's the big AI labs are spending a lot more money enhancing those outputs than on explaining them. To its credit, Anthropic has done some strong explainability research, and now the Allen Institute has turned that mode of inquiry into a product feature. The lab flagships model can tie elements of its output to actual content from their training data. In a demo, AI2 research Zhong Lu showed me how the model, using a feature called OLMO Trace, now highlights and underlines factual claims in its outputs. Click on one and a pane opens on the right side of the screen showing the relevant excerpt from the source document that the model is referencing. That tool even labels the training data by how relevant it is to the generated response. Users can pinpoint exactly where the model learned its certain information, verify factual claims, and even detect potential sources of hallucinations, i.e. when models generate things that sound right but aren't true. Research and developers may be able to use the feature to understand how models behave during training and how why they generate content in production. Enterprises may be very interested in fact-checking model outputs as the risk of model contamination grows. AI2 has been talking about open-sourcing models and model transparency for years, and was co-founded by Paul Allen. The CEO tells me the tide may be turning for transparency in the industry. We started from the time that the word on the street was, oh, opening these things up is the worst thing you could do to humanity, to the point now where these big enterprise companies are fighting with each other about who opens up more. Fardy says that during the interview with Fast Company, so we see a big shift in the industry. Obviously, we'd like to take credit for part of that. That's all part of the story. The more people that open up, the better it would be for AI.